The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Terrence Washington, Manager of Civic Engagement and Programs here at the Free Library. I'm here to introduce our guest to the Free Library stage. Author Tommy Orange is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. Orange teaches in the MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts, the same program he himself graduated from. He's the author of There, There, a novel that tells the story of 12 interconnected Native Americans living in Oakland, California. There, There was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and won the Penn Hemingway Award, the John Leonard Prize, and the American Book Award. There, There was the 2020 selection for One Book, One Philadelphia, a program that I now supervise. I would have picked it if I had been here. Orange also contributed the very gnarly short story Cop Gras to Never Whistle at Night, which is a 2023 anthology of dark fiction by indigenous authors. Highly recommend. Read it. You'll be adjusting your posture the rest of the day. In the book we're here to talk about tonight, Wandering Stars, Orange revisits some of the characters from There, There and paints new protagonists in America's past. The novel examines the devastating settler colonialism of the United States through three of its forms: the Sand Creek Massacre of 1864, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, and the contemporary war still being waged on indigenous people. Joining Orange on stage is Tylan Aguayo. Aguayo is the co-founder and director of We Are the Seeds of Culture Trust, a nonprofit organization committed to amplifying indigenous voices through the arts. She also hosts From Here with a View, a podcast that honors the voices of indigenous artists and educators, and is a co-founder of Project Antelope, an online marketplace platform developed by indigenous business leaders for indigenous artists. Her other work includes the children's book, I Will Carry You, and the photo collection, The Warrior Project. We are so pleased to have these incredible people here with us tonight and are especially thankful to everyone in the auditorium for attending. Thank you. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Tommy Orange and Tylan Aguayo.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. I'm really excited to be spending this evening with you, and it's so wonderful to see Tommy. I haven't seen Tommy in a couple years, so we've been catching up backstage. Looking forward to this conversation. So should we get into it, Tommy, or do you have something you want to say before we do?
Like some kind of diatribe or like polemic thing. No, it's just good to be up here with you. And Tylan was a photographer for my wedding in 2017. We'd known each other for a long time, have a mutual close friend, and we did storytelling work together. So it was cool to find out that I don't look at my schedule because it gives me anxiety. Yes. So I found out super late that this was happening. Not that I was going to be in Philly, just that it was going to be you.
Right. Tommy just found out today that I was going to be here. So, yeah. So this is great. Okay. Well, first question. in chapter, and I'd like to say there will be a few, we'll be talking about the book. So if you haven't read the book, I don't know how do you deal with that? We don't want to give a lot away, but I mean, we're here to talk about the book, so.
Are we more worried about spoilers for the new book or They're There? Because there's two different things in play.
Okay. We should just go then.
I'll try to walk up the line.
We'll figure it out. So in chapter 4, you write, stories do more than comfort. They take you away and bring you back better made. And I think about stories a lot. I am the founder and director of We Are the Seeds, which is an indigenous arts organization. And I've started a company called Project Antelope, which is an indigenous online marketplace. And I work with artists a lot, and we talk about not just the art that they're making, but the stories behind them. And that's what makes the art important. And as indigenous artists, we bring so much to everything that we do. We don't just bring our own stories, but we bring the stories of the people behind us and the people, you know, the people who come before us. And often we are thinking about the people who will come after us. So for you, Tommy, I'm interested to know, what do stories mean to you when, like, intergenerational stories? Do you think stories have a deeper meaning or importance as Native people telling stories? Why is it important for us to tell stories?
I mean, I think there's two things that I realized that was happening in Wandering Stars that I didn't consciously intend. So, you know, there's like this idea of praying for the next seven generations. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize till I finished the book that there are seven generations in the book that I wrote in. And I've known about the idea of seven generations for a long time. So that was a weird thing. But there's also, in introducing yourself, there's this tradition of like, I'm here because of my parents and because of my grandparents and because of my, like, this acknowledgement of like, I am here because of who came before me. And in a way, the structure of the book has that. I wish I could say my dad, who, you know, in a lot of ways is super traditional. His first language was Cheyenne, and he's, you know, practices Native American church ceremony, and he grew up in Oklahoma and with old people. Like, his parents didn't raise him. He grew up with grandparents. But when I asked him, this man who didn't, like, raise us with the language, he spoke in the household, but we didn't have two speakers, and it's harder to create fluency if you don't have two speakers. When I asked him a few years back, how should I introduce myself in front of people, like, trying to, like, get at, like, give me, like, a traditional way to say it, he was like, you say, I'm Tommy Orange, and I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was asking. But I think there is some of that going on, because we follow this family line from Sand Creek, and the story that I tell at the beginning of this novel is a story that my dad grew up telling us, and it's about how he got his Cheyenne name. And it's a real story about a young man who saves a baby from the day of the massacre. That's who my dad was named after. And that's essentially the first story you get after the prologue in Wandering Stars. So that character ends up at a prison castle in Florida. And I found out about this way late. I don't know if you knew about Fort Marion Prison Castle.
No, I've only heard about it now since listening to your interviews.
So a lot of people, you knew about the boarding schools. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of Native people,
right,
know the legacy of boarding schools is this horrific thing where they, for decades, you know, punished us for speaking our languages, mm-hmm, and actively tried to Christianize us and militarize us. Or so I found out that the blueprint or the seed for the Carlisle Indian School was this prison castle. Mm-hmm. And that Southern Cheyennes, which is my tribe, were half of the prisoners of war at the prison castle. And prior to that, I'd already decided on the name of the novel as Wandering Stars.
Yeah.
And then I found out that the prison was shaped like a star, and that there was an actual prisoner of war there named Star, and another named Bear Shield. And Bear Shield is a name from a family in there. And it was at that point, doing research about this thing, that I found out about when I was in Sweden in 2019 at a museum for the translation of There. And I realized I was going to try to tie this family line together. So you would start at the Sand Creek Massacre with this family story and move through this crucial piece of U.S. history that most Americans don't know about. And it's a devastating piece of history. Mm-hmm. But it's very much looked away from And a lot of times, Native people, we carry the burden of whether or not we have a connection. It's put on us.
Right.
But a lot of people don't know. There's like 100 years of like, don't practice your traditions, right. Don't speak your language, instilled in children who then grow up, like, you know, pretty scarred and go on to raise children and are distrustful of institutions and have a complex relationship to their own identity and culture. And part of, you know, it was because this was my own tribal history at the origin of this thing, but also, like, I wanted to write about this thing that is a huge missing piece when people go to judge us in this way that's like, you're just too weak, and that's why you couldn't carry on your ways. The people are too weak. There's this like implied element of us not being strong enough to carry on who we are. When in reality, there's government policy and there's institutions in place
that are actively
decades at a time. And so wanting to tell that story so that the burden is not on us. And here I am now doing a polemic thing that I said I wasn't going to do at the outset. I just waited for the first question to launch into something.
Well, I think that you do that so beautifully in There and Wandering Stars. The characters are so diverse, and they all have different backgrounds and stories, and how you represent people that are from different areas and were raised in knowing that they were Native or not knowing that they were Native, and how they come to terms with their identities and interact with each other is really brilliant. And there are so many nuances that a lot of Native people understand. I think a lot of the outside world does not understand. I think some of Native people don't understand. And we deal with this kind of conversation in our communities, and it's hard. I appreciate that you're opening up that conversation. I think it's very tricky, and not just this conversation, but there's a lot of education that goes into the work that into your books. I'm curious where you, I love the facts that you put out there, and they're so important. And a lot of times the characters are speaking them out loud or they're thinking them. How do you decide when you're going to say, does it feel too educational? Because those are very important things. But how do you draw the line?
Yeah, it's a big risk. You don't want to feel like you're getting pedagogical.
Teaching. Yeah.
In the middle of a novel, the last thing you want people to pay attention to is, like, the author is speaking.
Yeah.
Like, that's the right. Worst thing that can happen while somebody's reading fiction. You want to be drawn in by the story, and you want to keep believing that the story is the only thing happening. So it's tricky, and maybe I don't always do it well. But I also think, as Native people, we do obsess over history, and we do actually speak in terms of, like, did you know this? Because this is fucked up, because most people don't know this.
We don't have a choice when we walk out the door. That's what we're doing all day. That's what we're thinking and doing.
So there's an element of, like, there's such an absence of information for us to be thinking about information that affects us and that affects the narrative that is not being told. You know, when most of institutional education is a 400-year-old pilgrim story that's, like, mostly about a meal every year, then we think about the facts that aren't there. And so I hope that the places that these facts do come in are realistic, because that really is stuff that we think about.
It's absolutely true. And I think you do it so well. I think I pick up on it because I get excited about it. I'm like, oh, I talked about that. Like, you know, that's something that people need to know, because it affects us and it affects how people perceive Native people and our place in this world and how we impact the world. So I really appreciate it. I would love to move on to talk about love, because I feel like there is a lot of it in your stories, but in listening to the interviews I've listened to or reading some articles, I haven't really, and I may have missed them, but I haven't really seen much about love. And I think...
Says the woman who photographed my wedding. Ouch.
I didn't say about the wedding. I mean, the wedding was wedding was gorgeous. The wedding was absolutely gorgeous. Our lives are filled with love. What I'm saying is that the books are filled with love, and it may not be obvious or like immediately evident, but I wrote down some places where it might not seem... But to me, when Opal takes Lonnie out for pizza and video games, something's going on, I have to figure out what it is, and they share a pizza. Opal communicating with her, see, this is a spoiler, and
I think it's too late.
Okay. I know this isn't Andy's walking out, because we just had this conversation. Okay, Andy's outside now. Opal communicating with baby. And then I was thinking, even Sean telling Orville, I got you. And that's such a destructive thing, but there's this kind of, and so there to me, I felt like there's the characters, sometimes they weren't given love or they don't know how to love, but they have love in them and they're expressing it in the ways that they can. And that theme or that feeling really popped up a lot for me. And so I would love it if you would share. I would love if you would share more about that.
No, I appreciate that. And, you know, I don't necessarily in any of my writing write about romantic love, but I definitely lean into familial love and where it succeeds and where it fails. And this family who is at the core of Wandering Stars is trying to find a way to keep loving each other even though they keep hurting each other. And one of the things that is obstructing that is addiction. And it's also like the ways that everyone reacts to the fear that things might be worse than they are. And that's something that the people in the family notice. So you get everyone's orbiting around trying to recover from a shooting at a powwow that happens in the first book. And everyone deals with it differently. And love is what permeates, you know, I'm not thinking of that when I write, but the overall emerging thing that keeps everyone together is love, for sure.
It's there. So I have two quotes here that I would love if you would read, and then we can chat.
When you will learn all about what they know about being Indian, you will wonder if you have it in you. It will not be hard to find what matches. What is Indian in them, how that is what is Indian in you. You will know it in their laughter, how they need to laugh, how they love to tease and twist and poke at you. Talk about back home. You will hear them talk about loss. You will feel and talk about loss with them. Feel and talk about loss and feel and talk about loss. Laughing all the way through the nights.
I thought that page of the book was so powerful. And there were a few sections in the book that resonated in this way, where there's a coming together of different type of different Native folks with different backgrounds. And even the folks that didn't grow up in a certain way still had it inside of them and still could feel these things. And I would love it if you would elaborate on how you came to that and why you thought it was important to share that.
So these lines are from a chapter called Victory, and this is a character you hear about in there. So Opal Viola Victoria Bearshield. She gets Victoria from her grandmother, who's also known as Vicky. And her mom died in giving birth to her. She was raised by white parents. And in this familial line to get them from Sand Creek to Oakland and into the aftermath of there. For whatever reason, this came about, that this was the way that it happened, like sort of like barely passed baton of tradition and story that kept getting passed, because there's all these reasons why it's hard to pass things on. It's not an easy pass onable thing. So first you get, before this, you get a chapter that's Opal. This is Opal's grandmother. Opal from There's grandmother. She's telling the whole story to her child in the womb. And then you get this second person future tense directive POV, which sounds like super technical and like, why would I read something that sounds that abstract? But it's not. It's sort of a parentage POV. You sort of get the second person to the womb, and the second person becomes a sort of child POV of a parent POV. In the book, it feels natural, I hope.
It's amazing. It really is.
And the idea that even though she was raised by white parents, the knowledge that she ends up getting from her dad, that she is not white, because they grew up telling her she was Italian, and like people from the old country were more brown, and that was the reason why she didn't look like them. The knowledge comes from her dad that she actually had this Indian mother, and it changes her, and she tries to find out how that makes sense, and she ends up with a box of her mom's old things, which includes writings from her birth father, who died before she was born. And there's this tradition of things that get passed down. As close as they are to not being passed down, they end up passed down in these different ways. And she finds a way to embrace this. And this is a woman who ends up on the island of Alcatraz raising these two girls that are matriarchs, and they're. And so you find out about this history to this family that we then move on to as we enter this second and third parts of Wandering Stars. Did I answer the question, or did I just talk about random stuff?
I want to talk about, yes, you did answer the question in part, but I want to bring it to our communities and how that's a good explanation on how the characters got to that process, but when they meet and there's this connection and they're so far apart in the way they were raised and their worlds, we find that a lot, and I'm always just curious why. I have my theories, but I also wonder if you had thoughts on that. Like, how can someone who was raised a certain way thinking they were Italian meet someone who was raised more, maybe more traditionally, and then the jokes are funny and the sadness resonates, and how is that?
Right, like from the quotes that I read that I should be speaking to. I think there are genetic things and there are family lineage things, mm-hmm. and even like native lineage things that are definitely passed down. And I've seen it, mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with necessarily with the upbringing from certain parentage. And I think this is really interesting area to explore. It's a really interesting area to write about. I don't know, you know, how much proof there is outside of my experience, but the book is about this unnatural divide, and how do we cross it? And how do we find each other on the other side? Right. And clearly we have. Mm-hmm. People have survived a crazy extent and found ways to keep remembering who we are. And even, you know, sometimes I've been asked along the way, like, what are ways that you're continuing the culture? And sometimes it feels annoying because it feels like they're asking, like, are you teaching your son how to play the flute?
Right.
There's like this, like, undercurrent of like a stereotypical, like, are you doing the thing that
that they
want you to do for it to make sense for us. And it's like, in the example of my own life, like, I made a career of storytelling. This is traditional. I'm thinking about our people. I'm thinking about history. And I'm thinking about specific tribal things. And this is something that I'm carrying on into the future. And this is something that my children will think about with me in the context of the current culture of Native people. And, like, sometimes it's not seen as, like, what this is culture.
Yes.
And yet it is. And
yes.
But what people want is the Pilgrim Indians over and over again, or the Cowboy Indians over and over again. And luckily, like, a lot of the new representations and depictions of us in modern culture, like right now in the past like 5 years, have really done a lot to give promise that it's not going to keep being that way.
Expanding who we are and giving depth to who we are as contemporary Native people who mostly live in cities and suburbs.
there's a lot of work to do because we have a movie about to possibly sweep the Oscars that's still a historical depiction.
Right, exactly.
And told by mostly white people.
Right.
Not to at all take away from what
Absolutely.
Lily Gladstone is doing.
Sure.
And I hope she wins. And it's great, like, how they rewrote the script, and I'm not being a hater on the movie.
But that's a reality, that it tends to be the theme where they're historical films that at least get the recognition. But we're breaking out of that, too, with Reservation Dogs and Rutherford Falls and a lot of other things that are being... I agree. I've been watching a lot of interviews of Lily's interviews, and I love how she's doing the award circuit, and she's gorgeous and glamorous and doing all the thing, but she's always bringing it back to being a storyteller and the creative work and the work it takes to make films and the hard work it takes. And I love that idea. I think when she's being interviewed, they try to pull it into this very Hollywood type of thing, or aren't you lucky? Aren't you glad? How do you feel? And she's like, I've been working all this time for years, and I'm a storyteller. And, you know, she's getting the recognition that she should have gotten and that she has gotten for a long time. So it's nice that there's maybe a shift in a reframing. But I was looking down when you were talking, not because I wasn't paying attention, but there was a quote here that from your book that says, as all Indians alive past the year of 1900 are kinds of miracles. Does that sound familiar?
It's from the same chapter.
Yeah, so that's what we're talking about, that it is incredible that Indigenous folks were here, were around, and that we found community together in all the shapes and forms that our lives have taken.
Completely, in the urban Native story arc, could easily have become what they intended it to be, which was disappear in assimilation. Even in my own family life and a lot of people in my generation, assimilation was like the easier way to think about not having your kids face any kind of judgment or hardship for being different. And so that was part of me not learning Cheyenne from my dad. And but I think the fact that so many of us moved to cities, all the major cities have a huge number of Native people in them, including Philadelphia.
Over 14,000 people identify as Native in Philadelphia.
And that we started these centers and we built these communities that weren't even tribal-based, and we made these intertribal communities, and they are still alive and thriving now. Like, that is a testimony to the strength of who we are as a people. But it's not only just surviving and finding each other and starting up Indian centers. It's also like sending your kids to schools where the history is never told right, and continually watching movies and TV shows your whole life with your kids where, like, we're never there. So the extent isn't, I don't feel it's ever really understood. And I don't want to sound like I'm harping on, like, look how far we made it. Like, appreciate how much we survived. Because where we're at now is, like, this place where we can diversify this flattened image of us, and we can think about how many different tribes there are and how many different stories that means that there are. But I just don't think most of the country really understands the extent. I hate to keep saying that word, but it's true.
Like, understand or what
extent.
Word?
Extent. I'm sorry.
It's real. So there are over 562, is it right?
500,
no, it's 574 federally recognized tribes, and over 400, is it state recognized or not quite recognized tribe?
Federally recognized,
yeah, whatever.
Some are state recognized.
Yeah, all that.
Some are like weird white people tribes. For real, there's like weird Republicans doing tribal stuff.
Right, trying to just benefit and do some
percentage.
Very strange.
Like, out of the 400,
well,
that are federally recognized, I would say 300 are like legit tribes that just were decimated. The population was just decimated,
yeah.
And their numbers are just a little bit lower.
And then there are politicians trying to take recognition away so that to reduce, yeah, to do the same old institutional stuff.
Reasons, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how we got on that. Let's go to something else. But in terms of, do you feel like there's a heaviness? So when we talk about who are we as Native people, right? And Native cultures, a lot of times people are like, is this Native culture? Is this Native culture? And there's thousands of languages, and you know, we all dress different, and then within that, we all just have different upbringings and have gone to different schools. We're very different. So why is there a heaviness? Like, and how do we always have to carry this heaviness? And that's, I feel like your book kind of deals with that in a way. I'm trying to articulate it. Like, do we live our lives? We have our families, they go to school, we choose what school they go to, we raise our children the way we think is helpful, that they will thrive. What is being Native? I guess that's the question, right? If you are raised and you don't play the flute, mm-hmm. right? Like, are you lacking in something? No. But so when people say, like, are you Native, what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm sorry. I don't know if I asked that question in the right way. It's a hard question to think through for me.
It's tricky. And a big part of what I'm trying to write about in Wandering Stars is, like, giving context to how tricky it is. Like, I grew up in a household where my dad was his first language is Cheyenne.
Right.
He grew up with his grandparents, and he grew up speaking it in the household, but he didn't teach us that, and he was a little more reticent at the time. He didn't necessarily talk a bunch about what it means, with assimilation
Good reason.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of hurt from his childhood that he saw not talking about it as protecting us from it. So he was not accepted by his mother or father. So that he carried a lot of pain. And Opal sort of mirrors my dad. Like, she thinks by not showing them culture, she's protecting them, because
right.
she was on a prison island and found out her mom had cancer, and she also relapsed and then died. Like, super traumatic, horrible thing. Like, let's just do good in school, let's be pragmatic. And this is a common, like, even immigrant experience,
mm-hmm.
or people of color experience, or poverty experience, where it's like, work hard and go to school and be pragmatic.
Don't make waves.
Yeah, exactly. And
yeah.
And get a good job, and we got to get out of what this is.
Right.
So, you know, what being Native means, there's not an answer.
Right.
What it means mostly is way more than we ever think of it, because we think of it for a month, maybe a week in November, and we've mostly thought of it historically, and we have people like Elizabeth Warren and a lot of other pretendians with family stories that dilute the idea that it doesn't hurt her. She got out of it. She's fine. But then people look at us. If we don't look like the phenotypical Native person, or we don't have the story, or we're not wearing the clothes, or we're not blowing a flute, they're like, well, how are you? You know, when I first started the book tour, there was a long line of people before the book even came out. And somebody came up and she was like, well, what's the book about? What's the big deal? Because she stood in line for a long time. And I was like, I don't know why you stood in line. And I was like, it's about Native people living in Oakland, and they end up at a powwow and things don't go well. And she's like, are you Native American? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, well, how much?
Yeah.
So there's this idea that, like, that there aren't any real ones, and there's a lot of fake ones, and this
and maybe she expected you to look a certain way or be dressed a certain way.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you have 1,000 nations in a country that is here but doesn't exist anymore, there's a lot of stories that we need to fill in to help people think about the diversity and the nuance and complexity of what the people look like now.
Thank you for doing that. That is complicated and complex work, and you're doing a beautiful job of it. So I'm really honored to be able to have had this conversation with you today. And we're going to open this up for audience questions.
In your book, There, you said a quote, a spiderweb is like a home and a trap. Did you learn that from anybody close to you? And if you did, who? Also, why did you decide to end the book There the way you did, with a lot of like unended like questions and stuff?
So the line home in a trap just came from writing the novel. It's not something I ever heard before. I like open-ended endings. I know you don't. So, you know, I think writers write the books that they want to be in the world. And I think open-ended endings engage not only an imagination in the reader, but a heart and a hope. Because you have to decide for yourself, you have to challenge your belief. What do I think happened? How cynical am I that I'm going to choose this way or that? Or how much belief do I have that I'll choose this way or that? So I like that piece of open-ended endings. I will say the next book, this is not a spoiler, has more resolve.
Hi. This might be redundant, so feel free to throw it out, because you've talked about the importance of telling stories. I wonder what you're like as a teacher and what it means to you, maybe especially at IAIA, to be sort of helping people tell stories.
I think there's a dishonest way to answer this. It makes me sound like a altruistic, like, teacherly person. But I've been teaching at the school since 2017. Have only ever taken on between 1 and 4 students. And it's a low residency program. And so it's pretty minimal what I do. I do try to, you know, promote students that end up with books coming out of the program. And I do try to help students that I work with. But I can't pretend that I'm like doing the serious work that I know a lot of teachers do. And a lot of writers who are teachers put a ton of their life force and time in the world. And I'm not doing that.
Super big fan here. Sorry. I was just wondering what you talked about with like reservation dogs and other people's stories. Do you have a list that you recommend? Is it anywhere that we can access? Or is there anybody that you feel like is a personal hero to you?
I mean, I'll just try to throw out some things.
True Crime.
True Detective, the newest season.
True Detective? Sorry, True Detective.
is excellent.
It's amazing.
Yes. Reservation Dogs.
Kaylee Reese is bomb.
Yeah. Rutherford Falls. Look into Michael Greyhorse's IMDb and Lily Gladstone's. Grey Eyes. I said Grey Horse. Grey Eyes. Look into Lily Gladstone's IMDb. There's lots of good movies. Look at Wes Studi's IMDb. There's a lot of amazing TV, movie, book things happening that is very easily look upable. But I don't have like a Tommy's cheat sheet to finding that out .com situation happening.
I just wondered, at what point did you decide you were going to bring some of these characters into Wandering Stars that were in They're There? Was it while you were still writing the first book, or was it afterwards? Like, did they kind of come back to you, or what did that look like?
So the beginning of writing Wandering Stars was really weird. I was north of Baltimore signing thousands of books, copies of They're There, at a warehouse, a Penguin Random House warehouse, and they were playing a Spotify playlist based on the root was There There by Radiohead, and Wandering Stars by Portishead came on, and in a single moment, I decided, like, oh, I'm gonna write a sequel, and it's gonna be called Wandering Stars. No idea why I was convinced of it. A lot of weird things happened afterward that convinced me. And the first stories that came, I don't think I've ever told anyone this except my wife. I was writing the afterlives of the dead people from There There. And there was this weird narrative where Tony Loneman was both living with Maxine as a ghost, his grandma, but also at the very outer edge of the universe. So if the universe is expanding, right, and that's everything, what is it expanding into? That doesn't make sense, right? Mm-hmm. There has to be something right on the other side. So I had Tony Loneman at the outer edge of the universe expanding in as sort of like an afterlife capsule that was like a star sort of being birthed. This was the beginning of writing this book. None of it exists in the book at all. But I was convinced by the title, and I wrote a bunch of afterlife lives that my editor was like, we're not doing this. So that was where that started. But I always knew Orville and the family was going to be a core part of it. So eventually I found my way to writing about it, because the metaphor of like recovering from a mass shooting event, and then he gets addicted to painkillers. So a mass shooting and opioid crisis thing to write into it and have people and have a historical piece. There's a lot of layers that I felt like I could write into, and that was part of why the decision. But also just that's like a core family from there, and I wanted to keep writing into them.
Hi, Tommy. Thank you for being here. Bit of a longer question, I guess, so I wrote it down. It seems that the experience that you write from and write about is one that comes from a place of like intense fracturing, and you talked about that a lot in this conversation. And so many of your characters seem to have that general unknowing about the way they move through the world. And I guess I'm wondering like what the process of rendering such a complicated, diverse, and fractured experience is into a novel that's like incredibly legible and super like ultimately comprehensible to someone that, you know, hadn't experienced that, while maintaining a sense of fracturing in each of your characters. So if you could speak to that, that'd be really great.
Yeah, thank you. That's a super nice question. You know, it took 6 years to write There, and then 6 years to write this book. It helps having an editor. She thinks about readability and story. I think about it too, but she's better. And so I throw a lot of stuff at the wall. Don't send it to her yet. I see what sticks for me. I get drafts together. Eventually, my best friend Mario read a 2020 draft, he's right here, that is unrecognizable from what this book is now. That definitely was not good, and I appreciate that he read it. So, you know, it's figuring out, like, the fracturing piece is, I think, a part of who I am and where I write from. And so that's easy to keep intact. But the process of keeping a story together and keeping it readable is collaborative. It's with my editor. It's with sending to different people that I trust. Like, how's this working? And I don't send to people who are, like, too real or mean, because I need to keep writing in it. And if people are like that, then I'll just hold on to what they say too tightly and get paralyzed. So, you know, it's a process, 6 years, and focusing on structure and story and voice, but ultimately, how do you keep this tight and readable while also exploring such a fractured thing with all these different voices? It's challenging, and that's part of why I think it took a long time, and I really don't want to take 6 years on the next book. So I got to figure out a different formula.
Hi, I have a bit more of a technical question as well. I'm curious about the ways that you found yourself modifying the voice and vocabulary of Wandering Stars as opposed to, as compared to There. So I see the novel broadening in its setting in two senses, both in location, moving from California to other states, and then to a broader time period as well. So what were your inspirations and challenges capturing voices in new settings?
So I read a lot. For the historical stuff, I researched a lot. Like, I immersed myself in reading text from these time periods. And, you know, I just hoped that by immersing myself in people talking about these times, when I went for this sort of, because I bend toward the interior, that it captures something that I'm influenced by immersing myself in this older way. You know, I don't know how much I succeed, but there was a ton of research for the historical parts that influenced how I tried to change syntax and change detail and setting so that it felt like it was from that time. It was super challenging. It was totally different from there. Just, like, mostly personal experience. And, you know, the second two-thirds of Wandering Stars is also mostly experientially based. So it was a new thing, and it was hard. But it was research and some of the same stuff, like reading out loud to myself and thinking, does this sound true? Maybe not to the time, because I'm not a historian, and I don't know enough about syntax in that regard. So there are definitely things, if you're looking really hard at it, that's like, this is a contemporary novelist writing about the interior lives of historical people that would never think these things. That's probably there. But I think it works if you don't stare too hard. So I hope you all don't stare too hard at it.
I thought that the prologue of There was breathtaking in the best possible way, literally had the reader gasping. I'm wondering how you chose the facts and events that went into that. And is that a different authorial voice for you than the one that writes the stories of your characters? And is there a similar breathtaking prologue in Wandering Stars?
I'll answer the last part first. There is a prologue at the beginning. I haven't heard yet anybody call it breathtaking. I've read from it, and I haven't heard anybody go... So I don't know. It's not as long. It's about thematic things like the boarding schools and the origin of the boarding schools at the Fort Marion prison castle. Choosing what, you know, with the There prologue, It was a sprawling mess of a thing that I wrote over a lot of different years. It was 14 or 15 pages long, and my editor was like, this is too long, we're not doing this. And I cut it in half, and that's how we ended up with the interlude in there. I was like, now we have an interlude. And it informed like these mini chapters that then informed sort of these other mini chapters at the end of there. So it was working with the editor and figuring out like how to sneak things in that she was trying to cut out informed the form of the thing. With this, it's a shorter prologue. It's very pointed at this piece of history that we go into in the first 100 pages of the book that I think a lot of people don't know about, even Native people. I didn't know about it. I found out when I was at a museum in Sweden. Like, I wouldn't have written the book this way if I wasn't at this. It was for the translation of there in Swedish. By chance, I saw a newspaper clipping on a wall in a museum, and I found out about this piece of history about the Fort Marion prison castle. So that was like, did I choose those facts? It was just, it was there all of a sudden, and it was Southern Cheyenne history that I didn't know existed. The authorial voice. I don't know. When I write prologues, if I tell myself I'm writing essay or nonfiction, then I'm not going to write it, or I'm going to think of it as homework. If I can always think that it's fiction, then I more want to write it. I have a resistance to essay because the way essay is taught in schools is complete bullshit. And it messed me up, and it still, I think, messes with me. So I trick myself into writing essay because I'll admit it's like essayistic, but I hope to write like a book of essays at some point, and I don't know what trick I'll use to do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Tommy.
Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.